three distinct inflection points that we can get on this computer. So we go from three columns to two columns, images to one column, logo are scaling, the navigation is changing, image sizes are scaling, text is rewrapping. So it's a really nice experience. And it's used as like the example of responsive web design right now because Ethan Marcotte led the design team on the effort. Mm-hmm. And he's the guy who wrote the book, so of course it's going to behave the way the book says it should. Because it's the same people. So the question then is, how do we design for this? Because our design documents are static, right? We could effectively still be printing out all of this stuff and showing it to clients on paper. Because there's nothing dynamic, there's nothing flexible or adaptive, there's nothing responsive about our design documents. They're rigid pixels. But we're trying to capture behavior, right? We're trying to figure out, how does this thing actually scale? Where are the inflection points for when we want to switch the layout? So I'll just show you briefly some of the ways that we've started to think about it at Fluid and are starting to adapt our process. So here are, this is just a map of proportionately speaking, different screen sizes. Semi-proportionately, so that we can see what's going on in the different orientations. So for many devices, this first column, we have both portrait and landscape that we need to be concerned about. So here's your iPad resolution. Here's Motorola Zoom and Galaxy Tab 10 resolution. And then we've got other resolutions in like 7-inch tablets and high-res smartphones and low-res smartphones and stuff like that. And there are other resolutions that are out there. So it's a real challenge when we start looking at things like the fact that there's overlap. So this is a layout that is 480 wide, and this is a layout that is 480 wide. Does that mean that this scales up to that? This lays out exactly like that, but it changes when we flip over and turn it? So if I change from portrait to landscape, do I change my layout or do I scale it wider? 960 and 768 overlap. So is this one layout, but then it switches to another here, but this is different because this is wider than that is? So the first thing that we're challenged with is figuring out what are the inflection points. And so one way is to say, well, we just use whatever our max width is at some point and say that's an inflection point. So we've got some proposed inflections at these points, 320, 480, 600, 768, 1024, and 1200. And I think these are the proposed inflections that come from the responsive web design book, roughly somewhere in there. So we potentially have six different inflection points in layout. Which means that as I transition from 320 to 480, I could potentially, and we're not talking about just scaling something up, I'm talking about going from like one column to two column, or one column to a different layout, and from 480 to 600 and so on. So the first thing that we want to keep in mind is that when we are between inflection points, we're just talking about how things are going to scale and rewrap. We're not changing the overall layout. We're not changing where things are located. We're just changing size and text wrapping. So it's just text is going to reflow, images are going to get bigger or smaller. But then when we cross an inflection point, we have the possibility, not mandatory, but we have the possibility that we could now switch our layout, say one column to two column to three column to four column or something like that.
When you say inflection points like 320, 480, it's the width, right? Horizontal width.
Right. Yeah. The height, you know, we always are going to base the layout on the width of the device because that's how people are going to be seeing.
See, the problem is like for a cell phone and tablets, most time people look at it in portrait mode. Mm-hmm. But for like a laptop and a desktop, it's landscape. So
which is why these are only shown in landscape. You probably all have seen the monitors that people flip up and put a monitor in portrait mode. Actually, there seems to be a rash of that on Twitter right now, where people are sharing their desktops with their portrait mode, 32-inch monitors in portrait mode. And it looks kind of cool, I have to confess, because it still gives you, an HD monitor still is giving you 1080 wide, so your web pages are still rendering pretty well if they were optimized for 1024, but you get to see like 3 times as much of the page, so it's like a really long web page. But yeah, you're right. It's typically the mobile, portable devices that we worry about flipping, because they're the ones with accelerometers in it. That's why your screen knows that when you do this, there's an accelerometer in there that says you've just rotated it, and it adjusts. The desktop monitors don't adjust auto. You have to do that at the video card level. So they don't typically flip easily on their own or quickly. Right, so the other file that I have here then is just a quick example of one way that we could represent this. So I just scaled it down here. You probably can barely see, I can barely see. There are 3 inflection points for 4 layouts, 5 inflection points, let's see if there's more. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 inflection points for 6 layouts here. You can't tell, but there's a vertical inflection point here, 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 and somewhere around in here. And as we move from one layout to the next, so here's the layout at 320, 480, 600, 768, 1024, and 1280. So you can see right away that the idea is that things are going to scale between these inflection points. And now each inflection point doesn't have a radical change in the layout.
Can you
tell?
Oh, okay. You're not in Photoshop. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Is there a ruler somewhere? I just want to show the ruler. See. Okay. Nice. Better.
So at 320 to 480, I still have a one-column layout, right? I haven't gone to 2 columns, but I'm changing the navigational structure, and I'm changing the main image weight. It's like it's just a lot bigger. But now when I go to 600, I still have basically a one-column layout, but now it switches to a 2-column layout, and then it begins to scale upward from there. So there's really only, in the grand scheme of things, there's really only a 1-column versus a 2-column layout. But where this grid of images here shows up changes, and how wide it is changes. So here it's 2, now it goes 3, but as we get smaller, the text begins to wrap around it in a different way, and then it falls below a block of text. So it's changing. What we're challenged with is, the inflection points are the easy part. It's still a pain in the butt, because right now I have what was historically 1 wireframe, now has become 6 wireframes, because I have to show the exact same page and the exact same content in 6 layouts based on screen width. But I also have to layer in information about how it's going to behave. And so one of the ways that we're doing that is by annotating the scaling images right within the wireframe. So I know that this scaling image works between 320 and 320 by 240 and 600 by 450. In other words, this image maximum size is going to be 600 by 450. At which point there's going to be some layout change that will necessitate using a different asset file. So I'm not showing how this image is going to scale, I'm simply identifying its smallest size and its largest size. Now we have another issue, and that is I want this image to scale, but I don't want it to look crappy at the larger size. So we have to make a decision on the bandwidth end. All these things begin to tie together. If I load the 600 by 450 image and I scale it in the browser, I'm guaranteed that I'm going to get the best quality of that image at whatever the screen size is, because I've loaded the highest quality image and then always scaled down. On the other hand, if I load the smallest image and I allow it to scale up, it's going to pixelate and I'm going to lose the quality of that image. But loading the largest image for a small screen size means that I have a greater bandwidth requirement. I'm going to have a bigger file size and it's going to take longer to load. So we have to make a judgment call at that point. Do I accept pixelation on upsampling, scaling a small image up? Not usually. Do I accept a larger file and a greater bandwidth requirement by loading the largest possible image and scaling it down in the browser? It looks best that way, but it's a problem for the bandwidth. Or do we break this up into different image sets? Like this image will be a maximum size of 480 and lower, and then there's another image that would be loaded at above 480 to 600. So it could be that this image now has two versions, a small and a not so small version. And we use a second set of media queries. In other words, I have to add another inflection point somewhere in here that says, all right, at this point now, change that image. So instead of going up to 600, it only goes up to 480. And I load the 480 image and scale down. So that just opens up discussions. The assumption in our wireframes is that each one of these different inflection points shows me the layout of the elements. Anything that scales based on the layout is going to be noted in the wireframe. And it is assumed that text will reflow. So that's just a given. Text is going to reflow to the larger width. So as I move through this, I see my column just gets wider, my text simply reflows. But I go from two images to three images. Now this can be accomplished with nothing more than CSS float properties, right? Because this is the same image that is going to scale from 150 to 190 pixels. Here, it's that image, 150 by 190. It gets larger, larger, larger until three could fit across, and then it reflows and they drop back down to 150. And then it gets larger, larger, larger until I've got three images at 190. So now it's a combination of image scaling and CSS float properties. So we're just showing how things are going to change in layout, what will scale, and assuming that text will flow. And that's all we're trying to capture here. But we still are faced with the fact, we're still faced with the fact that one wireframe has become six. And we need to not do six times the amount of work, right? I mean, it's just untenable to do that. So we've got to figure out a better way to represent this. And I wish I could tell you we have a ton of solutions, because we don't. But what we are trying to do is to think about it in an even more abstract way. Like, independent of all of the content, what are the different object types on the page? What are the different layout rules and arrangements? And what's the behavior? Almost like doing animatics for responsive design. So another reason I wanted to talk about the topic in today's class, because last week we talked about animatics and the behavior of elements as patterns. Well, now, how do we abstract this more from the content to think about what are the page templates, basically? What are the layout rules that content can then be flowed into? And we're still working out what that level of fidelity is and how we might represent that. But it's a challenge that everyone who's designing for responsive web design is trying to figure out. The other thing that we're exploring is the possibility that, and eventually what will happen is someone's going to develop frameworks for responsive web design, and there will be libraries of CSS and JavaScript out there that you can just use. But we're getting to a point where static design documents simply do not capture the experience adequately. And maybe what we need to be doing is more designing and prototyping in code and less in static pixels. In other words, the interaction design team needs a core set of documents that simply represent the layout, but then we generate coded responsive examples that actually show the behavior in a browser, so that as I change that browser width, I get to see what the intent of the layout is. And now I don't have to do this for every single page. I don't have to do 6 wireframes for every page. I do for representative pages, and then I have examples in code of what the behavior is. So maybe we have a combination of designing in pixels and designing in code in order to capture the behavior. Because any static image is going to fail us when the actual end result is as fluid and liquid as a responsive web design is. And we're not going to do a version of every single pixel, ever. We're not going to do that. So we just need to strike that balance. Does anyone have questions or ideas about dealing with responsive web design and wireframing, storyboarding, animatics, motion, all that stuff? Still want to be in the field?
Do you guys usually design for the mobile device first?
That's a good question. I wish we did. No, we don't. And most of the reason is actually tied back to our clients and their platforms. As retailers, they've been focused on the regular site for so long, and they just have so much content and so much of the customer experience that has legacy in old school design, that going in and saying, let's blow it all up and throw it away and start over again, usually causes an irrecoverable form of apoplexy. So they have a difficult time with the idea of dumping everything that they're familiar with. And the platforms as well are trying to deliver, the e-commerce platforms are trying to deliver ready-made solutions where you put in all of your product data once and you get a website and a mobile site. And they're doing it sort of like the wrong responsive way. They have, here's the code for the website and here's the code for mobile phones. And you get one or the other, and the mobile phone experience is just templated, it's boring, you know, it's not even custom to the brand or anything like that. So I can't tell the difference between, you know, shopping at Diane von Furstenberg or Walmart other than the price point on these things. So no, we're not doing as much mobile first. We have a few clients who are a bit savvier, who approach mobile in a different way and understand the opportunities there, but most of them are, they're not willing to be bleeding edge. So they're gonna wait until everyone else has done it first and then they'll follow. What are you doing?
I mean, all of our stuff online right now is, you know, desktop optimized. We're just in the very early stages of creating landing pages and these one-off campaigns that are responsive.
That are responsive or mobile optimized? Or both?
Both.
Okay. Yeah, because you can be a mobile version without being responsive. If you're gonna really do it the nice way, then go responsive, right? So we will know when progress has been made. When we load a website on our regular desktop browser, laptop, tablet, mobile phone, and there is no little link down at the bottom that says desktop version and mobile version. So if you're toggling back and forth between versions, we haven't gotten very far. But as soon as you load something and it just loads what is best for that screen and for that device, and there's no little option at the bottom that says toggle, and the experiences are actually the same regardless of the device or the screen, then we will have made it. But not quite yet. That's our ideal. Okay, let's say this because I don't know if I accidentally changed it. Let's take a look at a few sites here. How many people are familiar with, have you looked at Kayak? Everyone knows Kayak, but have you looked at HipMunk before? Anyone know HipMunk? Okay, we'll take a look at that one. I'll pull up AirTrax. We talked about GrooveShark last week, right? So I'll just pull up these for now. These are web applications. These are sites that do things. They're websites with pages of content, and they have applications on them. So I think everyone's probably familiar with these. Just quickly run through. So Pandora and GrooveShark are streaming music applications. Hulu is television. You know what Groupon is. SlideShare is like a web-based Keynote or PowerPoint solution. Aviary Tools, has anyone used the Aviary Tools? Aviary Tools are a series of design and audio tools that are HTML5 JavaScript delivered through the browser, but it's sort of like Photoshop in your browser or Illustrator in your browser. And Evernote is a note-taking, note-tracking sort of document information management tool. So, but they're all web-based. They're all available to you through your browser. I mean, Gmail and Google Calendar and all that stuff, Google Reader, these are all apps. And these are all things that are not just page-based. That if we were designing them, we would have storyboards. We would have sequences of wireframes that show us the different states of the apps based on what people are doing. There are overlays, there's modal interactions, the screens change based on what you're doing. And we see it even more on things that are like tablet optimized. So you start getting into like mobile apps and stuff like that, where a lot of the mobile apps really are just running invisible browsers, Chromeless browsers, and they're just getting web content and displaying it to you in the wrapper of an app, but it's WebKit that's rendering everything for you on the screen, so you could just browse to it as well and it would work. They're just not delivering it to you that way. So all of these application-y things are designed, obviously, we have wireframes and stuff for them, but we have different challenges for what we represent. So that's what we've been tackling. Let's take a look. HipMunk. Let's head back to Hawaii. Okay. Go to Hilo again. This is one thing, I like this, but I have to relearn it every time I come to HipMunk. So my focus is in the depart field, and my calendar, which is past the return field, is active for that. So we'll go at the end of January, and now it automatically proceeds to the return field. We'll spend a week in Hawaii. There we go. How many people? Only six. Okay, three of you are going to get cut. I like the little flying hamster. Actually, he's a chipmunk. Loading. Okay, so what's nice about this is the visual representation, right? So flight, layover, flight. Anytime you see these white areas, it's a layover, and the size of the white is proportionate to the duration of the layover. So you see like Delta, short flight to LA, then you have an hour layover, and then you hop on Continental and fly your way on over. United.
Jeez.
You spend more time in Honolulu before proceeding to Hilo than you did getting from San Francisco to Honolulu. And of course, because United sucks. And then there's Hawaiian Airlines that connects you through Honolulu. Where's OGG?
I think that's Maui.
Is that Maui Kahului? Is OGG?
I think so. I know it's O something.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. But I now have the ability to dynamically sort these things. So by price, duration, departure time, and arrival time, pretty slick. And I can have preferred airlines as well. So this is a great example of a relatively straightforward app. Notice that there were no page refreshes, right? When I resorted, it just happened. That feels like a desktop app. That doesn't feel like a traditional website. So, from a design perspective then, we've got things that are familiar to us. Combo boxes. We've got a nice data display. We've got sequencing, sort of sense of place. Where are you? Here's our departure and here are our return flights. But we also have tabs, right? So I can get hotels or I can just conduct a new search. Thinking, it's like, well, how would I wireframe this, right? What would I show? do I need to show like examples of each one of these sort arrangements?
Agony.
Agony is a great one. Agony basically starts you with the flights that are longest and most efficient and have the best times, and then the ones at the bottom are longest, least efficient, and have the worst times. So here you have a departure, you know, of like 6 a.m. You fly east to Phoenix for a layover, then you fly to Honolulu for a second layover, and then you make a connection to your final destination on a different airline. So this is the most agonizing because it's very expensive. You fly the wrong direction, you have two stops, and you switch airlines. So an agony is very clever. It's like, I'm going to take the most painful one possible. So sort by agony and then start at the top. So you can imagine now wireframing something like this, right? It's a page, but you're probably going to have to show multiple states of this page. It's going to change state based on what my interactions are. One wireframe is not going to capture the behaviors and interactions on this page. We're going to have to show multiple things.
Are these,
go ahead.
The very left column where it says from number, are they clickable?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So if you click on that, that means you're selecting this.
Yeah, area. You'll go in and get more information on this one. So now it takes me to step two. I selected my SFO to helo. Now I have to choose my helo to
return
SFO, my return. Yep. And I can go back. No, I don't want that one. And then this tells me ranking wise. So there are 6 flights worse than this, 42 worse than this, or 42 that are worse than this. I like this. There's only one flight worse than this. This one says there are 2 more that are worse than this.
What does that mean, worse than?
Agony. I've sorted by agony.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so there are, according to this, there's even 2 flights that are more painful than this one.
Why aren't they showing up?
I don't know. That's why it might just be a screen size thing. Oh. I might not be seeing something because it's all packed into
what,
like.
What does that dock at the bottom do, the live help?
Live help? It just opens up. It's a drawer.
Nice.
Okay, and another quick one, this one's even more application-y, so you can imagine trying to wireframe it. This is at Airtrex. This is a company that specializes in multi-leg international travel. So you're going around the world, you're gonna stop in 17 cities. This is the company to go to because they can get you super cheap rates going from city to city. But what's cool is that they will also recommend different routes based on price. So if you say something like, I want to go from San Francisco to Bangkok, they may say, well, that's going to be $600. But if you fly through Cambodia, it's only $400. And so they give you alternatives based on price and distance and stuff like that. Or they'll say, if you're willing to spend a 2-day layover in a certain place, then you can get a cheaper departure on the way out. So if you're ever thinking about like doing a round the world trip, this is the site to go to because they'll get you on all of these weird legs and connections and layovers in cities that you might not have thought of to maximize your pricing. I've gone here and looked several times and done things like, you know, 8 trips around or 8 stops around the world and found like all of it for $3,000 in airfare, which is amazing. Wow. And it's like, and you're not like on standby as a courier or something. It's like you have a paid ticket. So it is pretty neat. Pardon?
Get me on a site now.
So you pick and you add your cities, and notice you have like mode of travel also. So what you can do is you can say like, I want to fly from San Francisco to Sydney, but then I'm going to take a train from Sydney to Melbourne, so you don't need to worry about that part of the trip, but then I want to leave from Melbourne. So you can put in your whole itinerary and say, these are the legs that I want flights for, and these are the interim legs that I don't like. I can fly to London, go through the tunnel to Paris, and then fly out of Paris. So I don't have to always fly into and out of continuous cities. So you can get really custom itineraries. And it builds it up for you over on the side as you go. So much more complex. So let's fly. Where do we want to fly? Let's go San Francisco to Honolulu. We'll go Honolulu to, what about South Korea? I haven't been there, that sounds. I've been seeing it a lot lately. Ooh, let's go down here. And let's get a stop in New Zealand. I've got friends in Wellington, we'll go visit them. Let's head up and we'll hit Mumbai. But now, let's do this. I want to show you how we switch. We'll fly to Paris from Mumbai.
I was hoping you'd pick something even more interesting than Paris.
Well, I wanted to just show you, we'll go to London.
Boring.
But for one of these, instead of flying from Paris, order, view details. I forget how to change my mode.
How many people get to go on this one?
Me.
We're not having a field trip.
Not on my dime. Oh well. They've changed the UI a bit since the last time I was here, but it's possible to toggle this airplane so that it says, you know, I'm not flying from Paris to London, but oh well, and then back again. So here's my round trip around the world, and then we do something like this, get prices. And then it shows me options. If you were to hit all of those cities, if you were to alternate cities, if you were to add some cities or remove cities, so all things. There you go, special value. But see, notice now that in black are the cities that I added, in green are the cities that said, if you fly through here, we can get you these prices. So it added some cities. So that's the special value. And then most for your money hits all of the cities that I added, and it adds a few more. But the timing
so is
may
it color coded? Oh, it's color coded.
Yeah, it's color coded.
Will it reorder? Will it only go in the order that you've indicated, or will it reorder?
I think it, I don't know, to tell you the truth. It may reorder things, but I think it tries to keep the black cities that you entered in sequence in the order that you entered them. I've seen sometimes where it would do something, you know, like Singapore, Wellington, Singapore, where instead of flying you directly from Wellington to Mumbai, it might go Wellington, Singapore, Mumbai. So it knows you want to go to Mumbai after Wellington, but it may add another city in there rather than say go to Mumbai first and then Wellington. Yeah. But you can imagine wireframing this out, right? It's a much more complex application. It's not page-based. There's a lot of information that is being generated. So these are the challenges that we're faced with. Not only are things responsive, but they're web apps as well. And we've got multiple states, multiple layouts per page, and a lot of things that we're trying to communicate in the wireframes. You didn't think when we were doing the projects in the first course that these nice little brochureware sites, I was like, oh, awesome, it's a wireframe. In reality, that's like the simplest case scenario, and this is much more like what we're faced with on a day-to-day basis. So let's do a quick exercise here in class this evening. We've got a screenshot here. I don't know, have any of you seen the site 90% of Everything? No. Harry Brignall is the guy over in the UK that manages the Dark Patterns website. So if you've seen we've talked about Dark Patterns before. If you've seen the Dark Patterns website. He's got this example that he posted up, which is a modal interaction. So you go to the London Times and you see this wonderful homepage, and then if you try to click in to read any more, they intercept you with what's called a paywall. If you want to read the whole article, you got to subscribe. And so he was fussing at the paywall. So here's what he's asking. Is it obvious that there's a free trial available? How long does it last and what content does it apply to? How do you feel about being required to enter your date of birth into a registration form and your full postal address and your phone number just to read a newspaper online? Like, is that necessary or invasive information? What paid packages are available and what's the difference between a subscription and a membership? What tangible freebies do you get with the membership? And so here is the large version. Oh, that's the live site, they've changed it. I was hoping that was an image. Oops, sorry. So we'll have to use the screenshot and enlarge it. Yeah, it doesn't have subsequent screenshots. Let me just zoom in on this as best I can. All right, so, as Dave fights with the browser. Okay, head back. So let's think. Unfortunately, they've changed it. So the design challenge for this, I'll go back and leave this up. But get into groups. We've got 3, 3, 2. Yeah, whatever. 3, 2, 4. Get into groups. Whatever works well. Mix it up if it's someone you haven't worked with before. But the idea that we want to accomplish here is just thinking about this paywall. It's a modal interaction. This is a real short thing. We've only got half an hour that we're working in. But the idea is, if you're going to ask for information to register, to subscribe, or to give free access, how do we want to display that modal hop-up? How do we want to gather the information? So if you take a look at this, so we've got learn more, sign up, and log in. Well, if we're doing this as a modal interaction, if I click learn more, how am I going to display more content in this hop-up? If I click sign up...
So it is already a hop-up.
It's already a hop-up, yeah. So how do I change out the content in the hop-up to learn more? Or how do I deliver that content? The idea is that we don't want to take people away from this, right? Because we have the context of an article they're trying to read. And they either want to find out, like, what's the deal with subscriptions, or sign up, or log in to get to their article. So we display the hop-up, but then there's more content. How do we swap out, like with Ajax? How do we show the content, but still make it easy to get back to the sign-up form or to log in? And if we sign up, how do we display the form fields, collect the information, and still provide access to, like, learn more? So I get the form field, and I'm like, why the hell are you asking me all of this stuff? Let me learn more about, you know, why is this information important?
Isn't,
why, like, do you need my birthday?
Well,
or something,
if you're already registered, you sign in, it will take you directly to
whatever
article.
Yeah, if you log in,
it's
just going to log you in and take you back to the article.
Yeah.
So it's just going to close that. It's the first two that we're concerned about,
yeah,
because they're modal interactions. So we have a page, and this hop-up comes on top, and now we need to dynamically swap out this content. How do we do that? How do we dynamically swap it out? How do we show it in the wireframes? How do we make sure that we still have access to all three of these things, no matter what's displayed in this modal hop-up, right? So it's kind of like storyboards. If you wanted to get really tricky about it, you could also say, what's it look like on the website, and what would be like a mobile version of the paywall? So think about, like, something responsive. How would we show this as a mobile version? So if you want to tackle that, you could do that instead, like a responsive idea. But it's just sketching, low fidelity, right? That we're thinking about, how are we presenting modal information? How are we adjusting the layout? How are we dynamically swapping things out and still maintaining a sense of place and context? All right, pick your groups. We've got about half an hour. I'll come around and answer questions, take a look at what's going on, and then just before 9:30, we'll break, answer any questions, and we'll release sign up for next week.